Anyway, yes, you were asking about the funeral. About what happened there. My God, Jim. It was 4 years ago, and I can still feel every hideous moment of it. It all came out at the pub afterwards in the quietest, least dramatic way you can possibly imagine, that Beth, my youngest girl, had had a long affair with Megan's husband. I mean, honestly, Jim, I had no idea about any of it until I suddenly saw her, the Irish girl, my husband's lover, or whatever. I saw her holding Megan's baby, and I said, "What on earth is going on here? Where's Megan?" And she told me she'd gone to find Beth. And I said, "Why?" And she said, "You'll have to ask them that." 5 minutes later, Megan returned, looking pale and traumatized. Her lovely pink shoes were covered in mud, and for one dreadful moment I thought she'd been attacked. She wouldn't tell me what had happened, but she went straight to her car, said she had to find Beth. She drove around for half an hour, but never found her. And the next thing was a text message from Beth saying she was at Heathrow heading home. We never found out how she'd got there, from the deep, dark countryside all the way to London. It really doesn't bear thinking about. Anyway, that was the last any of us heard of Beth. She changed her phone number and her email address and literally disappeared into thin air. And Megan told me what that Irish girl had said to her, and none of us would have believed a word of it if it hadn't been for Beth's reaction. As for Megan, she was magnificent. She absolutely dealt with it. Confronted Bill, got the truth out of him, made him suffer almighty pain for quite a long time, and then made him marry her. Does it seem terribly strange to you, Jim, that two of my babies are floating about out there, untethered? That I don't speak to them? That they might, in fact, be dead for all I know? Although I do have to assume that someone somewhere would find me to tell me if they were. It seems both strange and not strange to me. I can't really explain it. It feels almost, in some utterly foul way, preordained. From the precise moment that I saw poor Rhys hanging there, it was almost as though this were all inevitable. Or actually, no. From before that, from just before Rhys died. From the night before he died. When something happened that was completely irreversible, that would change the way I felt about all of my children forevermore. That sounds dramatic, and it is, Jim. Truly. I don't even have the words for it yet. And as long as I don't find the words for it, then maybe I can keep on pretending that it never happened. Much love, beautiful Jim. How I wish that I could just step into your arms and let you hold me. I bet you smell lovely. L. Kiss, 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 kiss. April 2011. Colin greeted Meg and Molly at the back door of the birdhouse in a T-shirt and boxer shorts. Meg recoiled slightly at the sight of his numerous tattoos. "My God, Dad, what the hell have you done to yourself?" Colin glanced down at his body and laughed. "I have to admit, it's kind of turned into an addiction," he said, adjusting his glasses. Megan frowned. "Don't get any ideas," she said to Molly, who merely gave her mother a "ew" face and said nothing. "I'd invite you in, but..." He gestured behind him at the dark piles. "Shall we sit out? It's another lovely morning, I see." He had Lorelei's laptop under his arm. He laid it on the table in the garden and thanked Megan for the takeaway coffee and croissant she'd brought him from the local cafe. "I've been trying to work out Mum's password," he said, lifting the lid on the laptop. There was a piece of paper inside with a long list scribbled on it.
"These are all the ones I've tried," he said, passing it to Megan. "Can you have a look at it? See if I've missed anything obvious?"
Meg pushed her sunglasses back into her hair and read the list, Molly peering over her shoulder, smelling of boutique hotels. He'd been thorough, that was for sure. He'd tried every conceivable combination of birthdays, children's names, addresses, pet names, maiden names, and favourite colours. "Oh, Christ," she said, putting it back on the table. "I mean, this is impossible, surely. We don't even know how many characters it's supposed to have."
"There used to be a guy at our school who could crack passwords," said Molly.
Meg and Colin looked at her and she shrugged. "Don't know what happened to him."
"Well," sighed Meg, "I think that'll be our only real option. We'll have to take it somewhere and get some propeller-headed genius to crack it for us."
Colin shrugged.
"I'll keep trying," he said, taking back the paper and folding it in half. "Your mum wasn't exactly Steve Jobs, so I'm sure it'll be something pretty obvious."
"You know she had an online lover, don't you?" Meg asked Colin. Colin smirked and shook his head.
"Someone called Jim," she said, "from Gateshead. Apparently they were madly in love with each other." She rolled her eyes.
"Well, that's nice, isn't it?" said Colin.
"Your mum always did need to have someone madly in love with her. Like a drug."
"We'll be able to read their emails if we get her password," said Molly, her eyes wide with excitement. "Her and Jim's love mails."
Now it was Megan's turn to make a ew face. "Oh, God," she said. "I hope they weren't sexting." Molly laughed. Colin snapped the laptop shut and glanced at his watch.
"What time are the skips coming?"
"Any minute," said Megan.
"Well, now, in fact."
She looked up at the clanking sound of metal chains outside the house. Two big yellow skips were lowered onto the road. Megan handed over £100 in cash. An arrangement was made for the skips to be replaced the following morning at the same time. And the morning after that, and the morning after that.
"We'll just keep coming every morning till you tell us to stop," said the driver.
"Bad, is it?" he asked, eyeing the scruffy house behind him.
"Really bad," said Megan.
"Funny thing," he said. "Funny how people deal with stuff."
He looked at the house again, almost tenderly, and he shook his head.
"Good luck. We'll see you tomorrow morning."
She stood for a moment on the pavement after the skip truck had left. The morning sun was already hot. She held the delivery note in her hand and stared for a moment across the street. The enormity of the task ahead of her felt heavy on her skull. Not just the physical work of it. Megan liked physical work. But the prospect of unearthing her childhood and finding it riddled with rot.
"Right," she said a moment later, clapping her hands together. "That's it. No excuses. Let's get going."
Friday, 28th of January, 2011.
"Darling Jim, I knew it would come to this eventually. I had hoped that you would have read between the lines of my words and seen the truth squirreled away in there. When I close my eyes at night, I dream about being with you. I pretend that you're there, with your big, strong arms around me. I imagine running my hands through all that glorious silver hair. I fantasize about seeing you across a room, sharing a complicitous smile, walking into a pub, hand in hand, sharing a bottle of, well, water, I suppose. In another, parallel world, you and I are living together. In a parallel world, your lovely things sit side by side with my lovely things. Your dog rests its chin on my lap at night as we watch TV together. In a world where I hadn't made such a mess of everything and everything hadn't made such a mess of me, you and I would be together. It's obvious, isn't it, Jim? It has been from the minute we first read each other's words. We are soulmates. But, darling, in this world, in this actual world,
which may or may not be the best of all possible worlds, but is bloody well the only one I'm aware of, we won't ever meet each other. Will we? Because I can't leave here. And you can't stay here. There's nowhere for you to sleep, my love. There's nowhere for me to sleep. Yes, it's that bad, darling. That bad. I can't bring you here. I can't come to you. And I know we could share a few hours with each other. Meet for a coffee, something like that. But really, what would be the point? An hour or two, snatched in the day. Barely a chance to get to know you. I'd be desperate to prolong it, to make it more. But I'd be snapped back to the pigging reality of everything. The pull this house has on me. The hold it has on me. I've given up everything for this house. But please, Jim, don't make me give up you too. Please. Can't we just continue as we are? These lovely emails that make my heart sing when I see them in my inbox. Can we do this forever, please? And yes, Jim, I love you too. Kiss, 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 kiss. April 2011. By the end of the first day, they had filled both skips to the absolute limit, and yet barely got halfway through the kitchen. The sun had blazed unforgivingly, more like August than April. "Do you remember," Meg had asked her father at one point, "that Easter before, when we were small, when it was hot? Do you remember the Easter eggs melting? And the paddling pool popping?" Colin had nodded and smiled, sweat rolling down his temples, a dusty box of tea lights in his hand, and said, "Of course I do. It was one of those times, those golden, shiny times when nothing could possibly go wrong." They sat now, the three of them, around Lorelei's table in the garden, drinking Coke, and letting the sweat dry onto their bodies.
"When do you have to go back?" asked Colin.
"Bill and the boys get back next Monday. Monday week. School goes back on Tuesday. So in theory we could stay for 2 weeks. But hopefully not." Megan thought about the boutique hotel. A £180 a night bedroom. She'd packed fresh bed linen and pillows into the boot of her car. She'd brought soap and flannels and towels and shampoo. She'd thought that within 3 or 4 days she'd be checking out of the hotel and moving into the birdhouse. She thought it was a matter of a bit of sorting and chucking. She'd had no idea. Absolutely no idea. "Come back to the hotel," she said to her father. "Come and have a proper bath. And we'll have a nice dinner somewhere." Colin looked at her gratefully.
"Thank you, darling," he said. "That would be lovely."
The three of them ate together at a seafood restaurant in the village. It was shishi, with dove-grey walls and prices written on the menu in fractions. Molly had ordered a tuna steak and was eating it like a man. "That was the hardest day of my life," she said, pushing her cutlery together and swinging her hair behind her shoulder.
"Plenty more where that came from," said Megan.
"We need more people."
"Well, actually," said Megan, "even if we had more people, there'd be no room for them."
"No, but outside, in the garden, to go through things. That's what's taking the time, sorting everything out."
"I just wish we could bin the lot," sighed Meg.
"No way," said Molly. "That's like her whole life in there, in amongst all the rubbish. Imagine if we threw away something really important."
"I know," sighed Meg. "I do know that. It's just so infuriating." "We could still get the council in, you know," suggested Colin. "No," Megan shook her head. "No, I'm not having anyone we don't know in there. It's our house. It's our life. No way." Colin nodded. "I do agree with you," he said.
It would feel wrong, somehow. His phone rang and he pulled it apologetically from his jeans pocket. He began talking sweetly into his phone, and Megan assumed it was Tia.
"Hello, sweets," he was saying. "Yes, we're all fine. No, not the boys. Just Molly. Yes, the big one. She's 16.
He looked to Meg, who shook her head and mouthed,
15.
Sorry, 15. Yes, I know. Yes, she's very pretty.
He smiled at Molly as he said this.
Yes, please, darling. Thank you.
He paused for a moment, as Tia apparently passed the phone to someone else, and then he laid his napkin on the tabletop, smiled at Meg and Molly, and took his phone call to a quiet corner of the restaurant.
Why has Grandpa gone over there to talk?
Because he's talking to Kaylee. Molly nodded knowingly.
I'd like to meet Tia, she said a moment later.
Yes, said Megan.
I know.
And you will. One day.
Yes, but when? I mean, I'm like nearly an adult. I'd like to meet her while I'm still a child.
Megan smiled. She sighed and said, Yes, definitely. You're right, it's crazy. It's just, you know, not talking to Grandpa for so many years. It's all been rather complicated. But definitely. Now we're talking again. Now I know... She paused, sorting her thoughts. Now I know that he's still just my dad. We'll sort something out. I'll sort something out. We'll go over. To Spain. Or something. I promise.
She covered her daughter's hand with hers and thought of Tia. Her beautiful lost niece. And she was just one piece of the puzzle. One tiny piece.
Maybe she'd like to come to London, said Molly. Maybe she'd like to come and stay at our house. She could sleep with me, if she liked.
Yes, Megan beamed and squeezed Molly's hand. Wouldn't that be lovely?
Sorry about that, said Colin, retaking his seat.
That's okay, said Meg.
And then she took in a deep breath and prepared herself to say something unnatural.
How is she?
She asked.
How's Kaylee?
Colin looked at her with some surprise, but then smiled and said,
She's grand. She is. She's good. Really good.
Yes. He petered off, aware that this was a new and slightly awkward development.
How's her business?
Meg forced it out. She had to. They were here now. They were a father and a daughter having dinner together. They were part of the same world again. Colin's face lit up.
It's great, he said. She's ever so good at what she does, you know. She really, really is.
Good, said Megan. That's good. And does she ever... Do you ever...
Megan held her breath, considered her next question.
Will you have another baby?
Colin laughed.
Oh, God, no, he said. No, no, no. We did talk about it. A long, long time ago. And we both realised it was just... Well, a step too far.
Megan looked at him questioningly.
Well, for Tia, I mean. How would that have been for Tia? A brother or sister who was also her aunt or uncle? Or... God, whatever, the technicality of it has always slightly eluded me, but no, huge age gap, a cultural divide. I felt, we both felt, that there were quite enough challenges to be going on with. So, yes, Tia is my granddaughter and Kaylee is my partner, and we shall leave it at that. As awful as everyone thinks it to be.
Molly stared at the table and said,
I don't think it's awful.
Don't you? Said Colin with a soft laugh.
No. I think it's just, you know, it's life, isn't it? All these years I've just thought it was kind of gross, and I mean, I
personally would not want to go out with my child's grandfather. But maybe I'll end up doing something else unconventional, who knows? And I really hope that if I do, and as long as I'm not hurting anyone or doing anything, like, illegal, that everyone would accept it, you know, just carry on loving me anyway. Meg and Colin exchanged a look. A look that said, "Dear God, what a bloody mess we've all made of everything." Then Megan's phone ding-donged and she switched it on to find a text. It was from Bethan. "I'm here. I'm staying with Sophie. At Vicky's old place. I want to help. I'll see you at the house tomorrow." Megan switched off her phone and let her head drop onto her chest. "Fine," she thought to herself, breathing in deeply. "Fine." "Beth's coming," she said, forcing out the words. "She's coming to the house tomorrow."
"Yes," said Molly. "Yes."
Meg smiled grimly at her, and in a small, dry voice, she said, "Hurrah!"
Chapter 12. Saturday, 29th of January, 2011.
"Darling Jim, I knew you'd understand. You always do. And you're right, of course. I'm acting like the future is inflexible and set in stone, like people can't change, like I can't change. And of course I can, Jim. Anyone can change. You should see my ex-husband. He went from being a rather mild-mannered college lecturer, a bit of a mouse, really. Or maybe that was my influence. Oh! And now he's all cool and groovy, living on a commune with a young girl, working with his hands, covered in tattoos, by all accounts. It was as though this other person had been living inside him for all those years, just waiting for a chance of escape. And maybe I have another me living inside my daft old body. A me who might wake up one morning and say, 'Enough!' A super little Lorelei bird who's all spick and span and in the mood for throwing stuff away. Who could contemplate a night away from home without breaking out in a rash. And my goodness, Jim, if that super little version of myself ever did find its way to the surface, assuming that it is there to begin with, you will be the first to hear about it, I can tell you. I would be on a train to Gateshead immediately. Oh, Jim, what I would give to have a night with you. I strongly suspect that you are spectacular in bed. But sadly, it is this little version of Lorelei talking, not that other fabulous one. So, yes, Jim, I will not close my mind to the possibility of change. And who knows? Maybe this love affair will change me. Yes, maybe it will. Maybe I will find that other part of myself through you. You darling, beautiful man. Until then, sigh, I will just ache for you. I have not had sex with a man for such a long time. When did you last have sex, Jim? Or actually, don't tell me. I'm not sure I want to know. Supposing you said it was last week, I'd have to die. I do love you so much. Yours forever, Lorelei." Friday, 4th of February, 2011. "Oh, thank God, Jim. I thought I'd lost you. I can't tell you how relieved I was to find your email in my inbox just now. I thought you'd finally had enough of me, that I'd lost you on the internet forever. And then I thought, how the heck does one find a lost person on the internet? I wouldn't have a clue. So to find that your silence was nothing to do with me, that it was just your nasty old demons, such a relief. What is it like, Jim, if you don't mind me asking? What is it like when you lose control like that?
on one of your benders. What do you drink? Do you have a tipple of choice? Or is it anything and everything? Are you happy when you're wasted? Do you feel better? Or do you feel worse? Do you get drunk with other people? Are you a part of a big, rousting, jousting gang of boozers, all singing songs together? Or is it just you, alone in a room? Or on the last bar stool on the left? Do you get into fights, Jim? Do you get into trouble? Are you a messy drunk? Or a quiet drunk? I feel the need to ask you these questions purely because I love you and because this is a part of you. I want to understand all of you. When I don't hear from you for a week, I want to be able to imagine what you're doing. I want to know how much to worry about you, how long I should expect you to be out of contact. Because if the superversion of Lorelei that may or may not reside within me fails to materialize, then I am asking you to stick with this version. And if the superversion of Jim, the one who stays on the 12 steps, who doesn't drink and doesn't keep vanishing, fails to materialize, then I fully intend to stick with this version. So I need to know it. Good and bad. Do you see? Anyway, I was absolutely dancing like a loony delighted to hear that you haven't had sex for many years. Sorry if that's selfish of me, but there you go. If I can't have you, then neither can anyone else. And if I ever get my hands on your beautiful body, I want it pure. I have no news to report, lovely man. It's business as usual here. Swimming, shopping, surfing the net. Oh, I forgot to say, I had an email from Rory. He is out of jail. He didn't have much to say for himself, but then he never did. Just that he's out, and he's considering his next move. Thank God for that. One tiny little sunray of normality shining down upon this wretched family. Love, 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 L. Kiss, 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 kiss. April 2011. Beth sat at the table in the garden. It was just before 9 o'clock. She already had a faint sheen of sweat upon her brow. She ran her hand up and down the cool sides of a bottle of Evian. Sophie had given it to her from her fridge that morning. Sophie had been so sweet to her, mothering her almost, even at 20 years her junior. "Make sure you drink tons," she'd said, looking at Bethan with concern. "You mustn't get dehydrated. It's forecast to be 30 degrees today." She'd given her a bag of yogurt raisins and a banana and sent her on her way. On the street outside, Beth heard the clank of heavy chains. She got heavily to her feet and peered out. It was the truck, come to replace the skips. Pulling in behind the huge vehicle was a people carrier, one that Beth recognized from her last visit to London. She pulled herself straight. She adjusted her smock top and wiped a glow of sweat from her upper lip. Megan slammed her door shut, beeped the car locked, and turned to see Bethan standing there. "Oh, my God," she said, her eyes locked upon Beth's stomach. "Oh, my God, Beth!" Beth waited, rooted to the spot. She could not, for some reason, make the small movement that might propel her towards her sister. Instead, she nodded and stroked her belly, waiting, as ever, for her sister to do the thing that needed to be done. Megan walked towards her, her eyes still on her bump. "My God, Beth, how far gone are you?" 32 weeks, she said. She was blushing. She didn't know why. "And they let you fly?" She nodded. "I had a letter," she said, "from my doctor." She saw Meg's eyes scan the fingers of her left hand.
"Wow,"
she said, that one syllable full of 100 questions.
"Wow."
She brushed the side of her face against the side of Beth's face, vaguely, as though she'd met her only once before. Beth saw Molly step out from behind Megan, and she smiled.
"Hello, Molly," she said, swallowing a gasp of amazement. Her niece looked like a model, all legs and hair and perfect feline features.
Molly came towards her and embraced her. Then she rested a hand on Beth's tummy and said,
"A cousin!"
Beth could see that Megan was surprised by her daughter's actions. So was she.
"Yes," she said, "a girl."
"A girl," said Molly, turning to face her mother. "Did you hear that? She's having a girl."
"How wonderful," said Meg. And Beth could not tell if her words were genuine or facetious. They all stood and watched the skips being taken away and replaced. The teetering piles of cardboard boxes, of newspapers, bin bags, broken lamps, ugly vases, stained duvets, odd shoes, splintered chairs and burst Pilates balls. "That was just one day?" asked Beth. Megan nodded. "One day. And approximately 3% of the hoard."
Hoard.
Beth had never heard her mother's possessions referred to as a hoard before. It had always been her mess, her stuff, her crap. A hoard. It made it sound almost like a single, enormous entity. "Well, hopefully an extra pair of hands will help."
"You won't be able to get in there," said Megan, nodding at her belly. "I mean, seriously, I can only just about squeeze in there."
"Oh, I'm sure," she began.
"No," said Megan sternly. "Really, you have no idea. You have absolutely no idea."
Beth laughed nervously and nodded.
"You look very well," she said as the three of them turned towards the house. "You've lost a lot of weight."
"Well, yes."
"And you, Molly, wow! I can't get over it. I mean, you were still a child last time I saw you."
Molly turned to smile at her.
"I remember," she said. "You fainted."
Beth felt a solid kick against the wall of her stomach and instinctively held her hand to it.
"Gosh," she said. "How did you know?"
"Mum told me."
"Oh."
She wondered how much else Megan had told Molly. Beth had assumed that Molly would know everything. She'd been expecting a cool reception. But Molly seemed almost excited to have her here.
"What are you going to call her?"
asked Molly as Megan rang on the doorbell.
"Oh," she said, staring in awe at her niece's satiny skin, her doll-like cheeks, the sweeping lashes and perfect nose.
"I don't really know. I was thinking of something old-fashioned. Agnes, maybe.
Or Maud."
"Oh," said Molly politely.
Beth peered through the grimy glass of the back door.
"Is this somebody actually in there?"
"Yes," said Meg.
"Dad."
"Dad?"
"Yes, he's staying here."
Beth blinked. She had not considered this possibility.
"On his own?"
"Yes," said Meg.
"On his own."
"It's all fine," she said somewhat tersely. "It's no big deal." Beth nodded and peered again through the back door into the kitchen beyond.
"Are you sure he's there?" she said as the seconds ticked by.
"Yes," said Meg, in that same slightly impatient tone of voice. "It's just rather a journey, from upstairs to downstairs."
"You'll see," said Molly, "when we get in."
Finally, the door opened, and Beth saw her father appear, in a scruffy T-shirt and shorts. His lanky old body was covered in tattoos, and she swallowed down a bubble of distaste.
"Move on," she reminded herself. "Move on now."
So she smiled and let him embrace her.
"Beth,"
he gasped happily.
"Hello, Dad," she said. "And who is this?"
he asked, cupping her belly. She smiled down at herself and said, "This is your next grandchild."
"Granddaughter?"
Molly corrected. "Yes," she said, "granddaughter." Colin looked from Beth to Meg and then back again, and then his eyes filled with tears and he began to cry.
"My cup runneth over," he said.
Beth thought of the last time the three of them had stood together like this. She thought of all the hurt and spite and anger that had controlled her actions that day. She had been so brittle and furious. Now she felt centred. She felt strong, she and her swollen belly. She and the baby girl who had finally made her normal. "You daft old fool," Meg said to Colin, and he smiled.
"Come," he said, gesturing theatrically behind himself. "Come into my humble abode."
Beth couldn't make sense of it at first. It was definitely the kitchen, but it seemed suddenly to stop about a quarter of the way in. There was a wall of stuff with a small gap in it, and nothing else. She turned to her sister.
"Is that?"
Meg nodded. "Yes," she said, "that is the only way through to the rest of the house. Yesterday morning it came all the way back to here." She pointed to the doorway. "Do you see now? Do you see that you won't be able to get in?" Beth nodded numbly. "So I think we'll need to put you on box sorting duty. We pass stuff out to you, and you sort it." She nodded again. "But, Beth, listen," said Meg. "We've only got a few days. You're going to need to be ruthless. Do you understand? Really ruthless. There's no room for sentimentality here, unless it's important. Unless it's documentation, photographs, or it's worth actual money, it goes in the skip, yes?" Beth nodded. And then she said, "But what about..." Meg threw her a terrifying look. She recoiled.
"Nothing," she said mock nervously. "I understand."
"Good." They shared takeaway coffees and croissants in the garden. They discussed the possibility of animal feces and decided that Beth should wear latex gloves. There had, of course, been a full, unopened box of the things in amongst the hoard. They talked about the horror of the coroner's findings and plans for a funeral. They talked about Lorelei, about her laptop and the mysterious gym. The sun shone. Bees hovered around the St. John's wort bush. A blue butterfly landed momentarily on the sleeve of Molly's hoodie, and they all cried out in delight. It was a perfect spring morning, and hard for Beth to believe she was here, with her sister and her father. She'd thought she'd never see them again. She'd planned never to see them again. And now, here they were. But they had not talked about the things that needed to be talked about. They had not talked about Bill. They had not talked about the father of Beth's child. And all the while, Lorelei's house sat behind them, with its thick layers and crusts and walls of composted newspapers, waiting patiently, ominously, for them to unclog its arteries and bring forth its buried secrets. Megan could feel herself physically bristling with questions. They were like tiny crackerjacks going off under cushions. She had barely recognised her sister standing there outside the house. She looked so solid, so substantial. Her black hair, which had been drab and dry last time she'd seen her, was gleaming and multi-hued. Her skin was plump and soft, like a girl half her age. Megan had had to remind herself that Bethan was actually 38 years old, nearly 40. Not a child. Not the one feeble thing who'd fainted on her sofa all those years ago. And that bump! So big, so proud. So full of baby and wonder and awe. But where the hell had it come from? For all the dazzling good looks and the big tits and the shagging of her husband, Beth had always seemed curiously sexless to Meg. Like her dad. the two of them, the dark horses. She had never before contemplated the possibility of Beth having a baby, because Beth had always been a baby. She'd always been the biddable dolly in the pink polka-dot raincoat. Even Bill had said she wasn't sexy. Not in that way. And now here she was, awesomely, in-your-face, fecund. And sexy with it. "Where have you been?" she wanted to screech. "Whose baby is it? What made you decide you were ready to be a mother? Why did you leave me alone for so long? What the hell have you been doing all this time? Who are you?" She saw Bethan eyeing the wedding ring on her left hand. She pulled it away subtly. Bethan clearly had questions of her own. But not now, she thought. Not yet. They could wait. Right now, they had a hoard to sort. Colin left the house for an hour and returned with four large storage boxes.
"One for each of us," he said, "for things we want to keep, for ourselves."
Megan eyed it suspiciously.
The thought of anything from this mouldering freak show of a house coming back into her own temple of pristineness made her feel queasy.
But as the day went on, she did find herself slipping the occasional object into the box. A set of four cereal bowls in lustrous pearlized pastels, an Art Nouveau soup ladle with roses on the handle, four unopened packets of plain red paper napkins, perfect for dinner parties, a simple turquoise glass vase, an ornate bone-handled cake slice. Beth found things to keep, too. A pair of mosaic vases, a set of fish knives in a velvet-lined box, lace-edged napkins, newborn nappies, unopened packets of pink baby grows, baby muslins, and a box of brand-new baby bottles. Molly put aside some trashy jewellery, retro sunglasses, candles, opaque tights, bundles of multicoloured elastic hairbands, and a framed painting of a kitten, which she said was so bad it's good. They filled the two skips again, mainly with newspapers and broken furniture, out-of-date food, things that smelled, and things that had no use. In between, they drank cold water in the garden and lay in the sun. Like any challenge in life, once the mind was focused on the job in question, it became a simple matter of getting on with it, inch by inch, step by step. They tried not to ponder the magnitude of the project, tried not to think about the big picture. Just each box, each bag, each drawer, each cupboard. And in this way, it began to feel almost normal, what they were doing here. As the shadows grew long across the unkempt lawn, Colin was saving the mowing of the lawn back into stripes as a treat to look forward to once the house was cleared, Meg told Molly she'd be back soon, and she took cold cokes and a bag of Maltesers to the end of the garden, where she'd seen Bethan heading a few minutes earlier. Beth was lying in the green rope hammock, cloaked in gold light, her bare feet crossed at the ankles, her hands resting together on her belly.
"Hammock's still here," said Megan.
Beth nodded and smiled and pulled her feet towards her to make space for Megan.
"I know," she said. "Hard to believe. And still in good nick?"
Meg sat down gingerly, fairly convinced that the thing would rip apart beneath their combined weight, feeling pleasantly surprised by the sense of being the lightest sister on the hammock, the smallest person. "Here." She passed Beth a coke. "Unless you're doing one of those really uptight, my body is my baby's temple kind of pregnancies."
"No."
She snatched the can from Meg's hand and cracked it open.
"No way."
"Thank you." She took a sip and then said,
"Sorry, I needed a break.
I didn't come down here to tell you off. I think we're about done for the day anyway.
You've done brilliantly, considering."
Beth smiled and stroked her stomach. Are you having a good pregnancy? Bethan nodded. Yes, she said. So far, so good. There was a brief silence. Hardly surprising, as everything in the universe sat on the other side of it. Megan pulled open a bag of Maltesers and offered them to Beth. In another world, they would be like the girls in the adverts, finding childishly adorable ways to make each other laugh with a packet of sweets. In this world, they were about to be very serious indeed. Megan started, because Megan always did. So, she said, where are you having her? Will you stay here? Bethan nodded. Yes, she said. It's good timing. She flushed at the realization of her words. I mean, God, obviously it's not good at all, but I've been dithering for weeks about where to give birth. And then I got your email about Mum, and it made my mind up for me. Megan nodded, and then let loose the next big question. And what about the father? Bethan shrugged, plucked at the ring pull on the drink. Good question. I mean, will he join you here for the birth? Is he Australian, or... I don't know. Beth stared darkly into her own lap. I don't know who the father is. Megan nodded, possible scenarios crowding her head. Beth sighed and raised her gaze to the back of the house. It could be... I mean, I went through a kind of phase. I don't remember much about it now. It was after therapy. I had all this therapy after, you know, Vicky's funeral. And it wasn't just that, what happened that day. It was everything. It was the panic attacks, the blackouts. It was Jason and Richard and you and Reese and Mom. Me, Megan cut in. Well, yes, I mean, my relationship with you, with everyone. Not just you, but you were part of it. And we went over so much stuff. I mean, things I hadn't remembered, thought about for so long. Like, for example, we worked out that the reason I'd always been teetotal was because of the smell that day when we found Reese. And Mom and Vicky, their breath, the red wine, was so strong on them, so rancid. And Vicky's teeth were stained red, and I'd obviously made this association subconsciously between alcohol and tragedy. She looked at Meg, then dropped her gaze and shook her head. And I got better and better, and the panic attack stopped, and I was strong and excited and thinking about coming home, thinking about you and Bill and the kids and Mom, and she stopped again. I went kind of too far the other way. Started drinking. Drinking? Yes, I know. And sleeping with lots of men. Lots and lots of men. One-night stands, mainly. I don't know why. I really don't. I mean, I've never been that interested, really, in men. In sex. Christ, I know that probably sounds weird to you. She finally looked at Megan then. Her eyes were filled with shame. Well, no, said Megan. No. Bill said you weren't that into the... You know... Oh, Beth shuddered and brought her arms around her knees. God, sorry. I mean, shit. Sorry. Meg, I can't even... It's fine. No, Beth snapped at her. No, of course, it's not fine. It's awful. It's evil. It's shocking. It's the worst thing I've ever done in my whole entire stupid life, and I don't understand it. I really, really don't. I mean... Her gaze went once again to Megan. You're my sister. My sister. But honestly, Beth, Meg's voice was soft, soothing. She'd come so far since that day at the funeral. She'd come through the long nights when she could have killed Beth with her bare hands, when she might have thrown Beth and Bill out of an aeroplane and enjoyed watching them spiral to their deaths. She'd come through fury and humiliation and shock and agony. Now she was here, in this bland place. And she didn't want her sister making it roar again. Honestly, that was then. We were all different then. I was different, Bill was different, and now we're different again. Yes, but that doesn't forgive what I did, does it? Nothing could ever do that. Not you, not the passage of time, nothing. It's here, she clutched at her heart. Buried in there. All the time, everywhere I go. And it hurts me. Meg nodded and touched Bethan's knee. It hurt me, too. It hurt more than anything ever hurt me in my life.
But look at us now.
You're about to have a baby. Me and Bill are happy. Are you? Beth sniffed and looked up miserably at Megan. Seriously?
Yes.
We are. But I don't understand how you could be.
Because we wanted to be, said Megan simply.
Beth flinched.
You're married, she said after drawing a breath.
Megan glanced at her ring.
Yes.
Last year.
Finally.
Although we got engaged a year to the day after I let him back into the house.
How long was he out of the house?
Megan sighed. She didn't want to do this. She'd put this all in a box and had no desire to unpack it again.
Few weeks, she shrugged.
It was bad. He wanted me to understand. I did not want to understand.
He's always been nuts about you, Megan frowned.
Yes.
I was just...
I know what you were,
he told me.
He said... Beth stared at her imploringly. She wanted to hear it. She didn't want to hear it. It would hurt her. It would help her. Meg sighed. He said that you were the other side of me. The side I wouldn't let him get to.
Beth flinched.
I know, she said after a moment. I knew. It was obvious. I knew it was never ever about me. It was always about you. Everything was about you.
Is that what your therapist told you? Meg asked with a grim smile.
Beth laughed a small laugh and let her head fall onto her chest.
Kind of, I suppose. He said lots of things. Lots and lots of things.
You were definitely part of it, but shit, I mean, there was so much other stuff. About Mum and Reese. I think...
Megan watched her sister, searching for words.
She was plucking at the loose threads on the hammock, her Coke can nestled in the triangle between her crossed legs.
I think, Beth tried again, that something happened the night before he killed himself. And I think I might have seen it, or been part of it.
Megan straightened at these unexpected words.
What?
I don't know. It's just this feeling. I've always had it. Like it was my fault. Like something happened and it was my fault. And I've kind of blocked it out. I used to have these dreams.
Megan stared at her encouragingly.
Awful dreams. About all of us kind of...
sexual. She shuddered lightly.
Well, that's fairly normal, isn't it?
Well, yes. And no.
Because I was never in them. It was the rest of you. I was watching the rest of you.
She shuddered again.
And Reese. Always Reese. My therapist and I, we never got to the bottom of it. But he thinks it's connected. To that night.
Megan shook her head lightly, trying to rearrange her thoughts into a recognizable pattern.
What did we do that night? She said. I can't even remember.
Neither can I.
Not in any detail.
I remember I had to sleep on a mattress in your room, said Meg, because Mum had dumped loads of stuff in mine.
I remember us lying there in the dark, talking about you coming to live in London.
Beth smiled sadly at the memory.
It was before that, she said. Early evening. It was still light.
She sighed loudly and stroked her belly.
Everyone was downstairs playing Monopoly or Trivial Pursuit or something. Something noisy, anyway. I came upstairs for some reason or another, I can't remember, and I saw Mum coming out of Reese's room, and she looked...
I can't really explain it, but she looked freaked. Totally, and
utterly freaked out, and I stared at her, and she stared at me, and I said, "Are you okay?" And she nodded, but I could tell she wasn't. And I just knew that something awful had happened. And I felt like it was something... She stopped. A significant silence stretched out. She smiled. "Oh, I don't know. I guess I'll never know. And maybe I'm imagining it anyway. You know, maybe I was so desperate for there to have been a reason for why he did it that I invented one." She shrugged. Megan smiled at her sister. She patted her kneecap and said, "The hardest thing to accept is that some things happen for absolutely no reason at all." "I'm not sure I can ever accept that," she said. And then her face brightened and she sat up. "Oof," she said. "She's kicking. Wow, really hard. Can I feel?" Beth nodded, and Meg put her hand on the hard, tight bump. And there it was. Bump against the palm of her hand. Bump again. The small heel or fist of her unborn niece. She looked at Beth, her baby sister, one of the greatest loves of her life, and she said, "I missed you." Beth took her hand, smiled, and said, "I'm back." "Are you doing this on your own, then?" Beth nodded. "Just me and her." She looked up at Megan. "And you," she said in a small voice, "if you'll have me." Megan squeezed her hand. "Of course," she said. "Of course." Chapter 13. Saturday, 5th of February, 2011. "Thank you, Jim, for your honesty. It was awfully nosy of me to ask, but as ever, you took me the right way. You are about the only person, Jim, in my whole life who has really known how to take me. It is a glorious thing. It was fascinating for me to hear, in your own words, how you feel when you're on a bender, although it did, of course, also make me feel unutterably sad. It made me want to rush up there on the first train and look into your eyes and hold your hands and tell you that I had the key to make you stop. But I don't, of course. I know as well as you do that only the individual has the key to change themselves. It's buried deep inside each and every one of us, and although someone else can help us to find the key, we're the only ones who can use it. And there, of course, is the pathetic irony that in order for me to come to you and help you find your key, I'd have to find my own first. It's all just a series of tightly wound threads. It's all just impossible, Jim, truly. And thank you, as well, for sharing with me the things that happened to you when you were young. You poor, poor little thing. Is it any wonder, really, that some of us can't cope with being grown-ups when adults treated us the way they did? If an adult cannot do a simple thing, like take care of a child, well, it's just an endless cycle. I'm sure your mother had her own stories, her own bad experiences, and so it goes on. You wanted to know about the blemish on my childhood. I can see what you're trying to do here, Jim. You're trying to fix me, aren't you? Long-distance analysis so that maybe one day I might be well enough to come and see you. And my goodness, I would like to be well enough to come and see you, so I will offer myself up to you. Analyze away! My mother was raped by a family friend. I knew nothing about it at the time, but my sister told me when I was about 16. Turns out it was the same family friend who tried to stick his tongue down my throat the week before she told me. I'd laughed that off. Dirty old man, you know. But then to discover that the same sleazebag had done what he did to my mother... And no, we never discussed it. I always wanted to. I always meant to. Every time I found myself alone with my mother, I'd open my mouth to ask about it, but the words wouldn't come. I was terrified I was going to rip open a wound that had healed. And then she died. And then my dad died. And that was that. Her rapist turned up at her